Today on the 21st, we're continuing our ongoing series about what people consume to escape or process the news. Today, we're talking about how podcasts fit into that with Nick Hua and Lauren Ober.
How does other media fit in? How does music fit in? How does TV fit in? How do movies fit in? And I think that as many topics as there are in those other in that other media, you can find them in podcasting too.
Plus, on this Good Friday, we revisit our conversation with Ignatian spiritual leader Becky Eldridge and ask, what does a 500-year-old spiritual exercise have to do with modern life?
Taking the last 24 hours of your life and bringing it before God is just as beautiful and profound of a prayer as sitting for an hour in silence.
And what does it look like to run off and join the circus today? We talk with a former Ringling Brothers performer who now teaches circus arts at Illinois. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We know sometimes, especially these days, the news we're talking about can make you want to run and hide or not listen to the news at all. So as we've been doing on occasion, we're continuing our series on news fatigue, where we ask what people are consuming to either get away from or process the news. We've talked about what books to read, what TV to watch. All of that's online, by the way, and we'll tweet out those links if you follow 21st Show. Today, we're going to talk about podcasts. Audio shows you can download and listen to directly on your smartphone or online, wherever you want to listen. I can think of no better people to talk about this than Lauren Ober. She's host of The Big Listen. That's a production from WAMU and NPR in Washington, D.C. Also on the line with us is Nick Hua. He writes a newsletter about podcasts. It's called Hot Pod. He also contributes podcast reviews for Vulture. Hey, Lauren. Hey, Nick. Thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, let's start with you, because as we've been doing this ongoing series on news fatigue, I mentioned books, a TV, I feel like podcasts are, of course, still having this moment where everyone's talking about the golden age of podcasting and everybody and their mother has a podcast, or I should say everybody and their nephew, right?
The moms have them too.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So how are you seeing, I wonder how you're seeing podcasts at this moment fitting into people's daily lives?
I mean, I think it's across the board, right? Like, how does other media fit in? How does music fit in? How does TV fit in? How do movies fit in? And I think that as many topics as there are in those other in that other media, you can find them in podcasting too. So if you want to get your political diet solely through podcasts, you can. If you want to follow all your trash TV, also in podcast form, if you want to, you know, if you want to listen to a fan podcast or something about the Real Housewives, you can do that too. And I think that, whatever topic you're into, podcasts will fill that, assuming that, you know, that's the medium that you want to consume.
Yeah, Nick, and what do we know? What have we seen in the past couple of months about, I don't know, I mean, we're going to get to S-Town in a minute, right? Because, of course, S-Town has now, like, broken all new podcast download records. But where are we at in terms of how many of consumption, sort of daily consumption of people and podcasts and where they fit into kind of everyday listening for folks?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think there are two versions of the answer to this that I think that is the most famous at this point. The first answer would be the ones that podcast publishers want you to sort of media type that you consume in between other stuff or while you're doing something else. So like commutes, while you're cooking in the kitchen, so on and so forth. But I think the second answer, which is something that I've come around to feeling that this is what the real sort of niche or novel value that podcast has, is it creates this really very, very sort of hermetic space in terms of a media experience. I think with television, with broadcast radio, with the internet especially, it feels that you're plugged into a much wider, chaotic world. But with on-demand audio specifically, it feels like you're creating very quiet, private spaces for yourself. And I think that ends up being what I see a lot of people responding to, particularly with the sort of recent string of new releases and recent string of developments in terms of programming.
Let's dive into recommendations, starting with the most popular one. Nick, you recommended S-Town. It comes from the makers of This American Life and Serial. Everybody's talking about it in its first week. It was like a record download, 16 million times. We have a clip from the first episode. You're going to hear the main character, Macklemore, being interviewed by Brian Reed. Don't worry, there's no spoilers here. Let's take a listen.
You know, I have this old crummy Ford truck. You can't be a redneck and live in Alabama without a damn Ford truck, can you? And I keep thinking, could I put everything that I would put in that truck and drive down that driveway for the last time? But then again, who'd take care of Mama? Who'd feed the puppies? You know, who'd water the flowers? Who'd prune the maze? You must think I'm just totally nuts at this point.
No, I understand. It's home.
I'm sorry if I got off subject and all that. You know,
no, it's all good. Well, I can point you back to it a little bit. Why do you think it's important to try and figure out what happened with this?
I believe we have a genuine murder that resulted from some kids probably picking on a boy that defended himself. That's almost certainly been covered up.
Okay, so that's a clip from S-Town on public radio. We cannot say what the S in S-Town stands for. Nick, what do you think about S-Town?
Oh, my goodness. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. Personally, it's sort of the most rewarding and probably the best thing I've heard ever, probably. It's a gorgeous sort of novelistic.
So, sorry, wait, did you say the best thing you've ever heard ever?
I will say it's the best thing I've ever heard. I'm unambiguous about that. I'm very, very honest about that. I'm surprised. Like, it's gorgeous. It's incredibly ambitious. It is so thoughtful, so perfect at such a high level. I don't think that something like this is ever possible. But it is absolutely gorgeous.
Lauren, what do you think about S-Town?
You know, I found myself.
It is. You do not think it's the best thing you've ever heard.
No, no. I do. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that they've made this miraculous piece of audio or this audio story without truly having a plot. You're hooked in because you think that there's sort of this investigation. It has this like true crime-esque kind of thing, just like its predecessor Serial did, but then of course it isn't about that at all, and really it's in the writing, and it's in the sound design, and it's in the character development, and it really is beautiful. And I think in terms of form, creating something that is more novel-esque or more literary is really sort of boundary breaking in podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's really interesting about that is the way in which the show very much grapples with the conventions of radio and attempts to systematically break a lot of things. And I think that was the only way into the story that it could find. It's a bit of a construction of a miracle. Like, from an architectural mechanical perspective, there's no way in which this should have worked. But the fact that they sort of lean into all those rule breaking principles, I think that's the only way they were able to string this along.
And it doesn't help, or excuse me, it doesn't hurt that it came from Serial and This American
sure.
Life, where
there's
a history of quality. I think if this had been attempted by somebody else, we might not even be putting our ears on it at all.
Yeah, that's an
Absolutely.
Interesting point,
yeah.
Lauren. Lauren, let's go to something else. A music podcast that you recommended. It's called Song Exploder. Musicians bit by bit break down their songs. We wanted to play a short clip from an episode where Solange talks about how she wrote her hit song Cranes in the Sky. She's just arrived in Miami. This is anybody who lands in Miami. This is the first thing you actually see, which is cranes everywhere. Let's hear Solange.
Literally everywhere that I looked around had a crane in the sky, and you could not look at a street without dozens and dozens of them. And it just felt really heavy, and that line immediately came to me.
Well, it's like cranes in the sky. Sometimes I don't want to feel those metal clouds.
So that's from the podcast Song Exploder, hosted by Hrishikesh Hirway. Lauren, how does this show affect the way you think about music?
Well, first of all, I feel like I have gotten completely overwhelmed with music lately. I used to go to, record stores, and I used to flip through albums, and I haven't done that in years. And I get totally overwhelmed trying to wade through Spotify or iTunes. And Song Exploder is amazing because it takes all of these all of these songs, both popular and ones you know that are totally obscure, and it breaks them down into their component parts. So you're getting more than just here's a lovely song to listen to. It's actually the artists themselves breaking down how they constructed them, and you get this sort of, you know, you see a little bit how the sausage is made, which is kind of a blessing and a curse, because maybe you don't want it's music feels like magic to me, and I don't always want to know how the magic trick works, but I think that there's a lot of value added to that, or that podcast gives.
Well, it's interesting that you say that about not wanting to know how it works, because, Nick, one of your recommendations for another podcast is On Being with Krista Tippett. And what I think is so interesting about the podcast is that she does sort of like this unfiltered thing where right. You can listen to the whole raw thing rather than the very published product that is the show that airs on public radio stations.
Yes. And it's like, I really do enjoy the unedited ones a lot more than the polished versions, because I think one of the more gorgeous things about, interview podcasts specifically, especially those that are allowed to be a bit more sort of fuzzy and hairy and sort of a little bit more itself, is that you hear people really try to work things out. And I think that is such a real gift to sort of listen to a conversation in which, you know, both sides, it's not particularly performative. It's actually two people really trying to search for an answer in the questions that they're either asking or being asked. And I think Krista Tippett does that very, very in a wonderful way. It's sort of like I'm always sort of I always marvel at human conversation, and I really like it when it's unedited.
It's really interesting because I've shifted all of my listening and I only listen to the podcast now. I never really listened to it on air on Being. So I think it's interesting for you, Nick. Like, what do you think makes the show most relevant to you right now? Is it just that it's that very human conversation?
Well, it's a human conversation, but it's also the sort of the project. Like, the whole concept around On Being is to have these conversations about really, really big stuff, like human existence, what it means to be alive, so on and so forth. And I'm personally sort of a news junkie. Like, I live on Twitter. I'm, like, very, very granularly oriented and trying to figure out what's happening. It sort of makes me a bit blind to the larger questions that, like, I would like to be asking more. I typically reserve On Being listening to, like, you know, my Saturday evenings where I'm, like, taking a walk, so that I have this sort of space to reconnect to these larger questions. And in a way that's guided, in a way that's sort of through a vessel that I trust, and the vessel being Krista Tippett, interviewer. She has a wonderful Rolodex of guests and just a wonderful mind in the way she works through certain problems and conversations. It's come to be a really big part of my weekends these days.
So from the very big ideas to celebrity, I want to go to Lauren, one of your recommendations, which is Who Weekly. And the tagline is everything you need to know about celebrities you don't. Lauren, tell us about that one.
We're going
all over here.
I know. It's highbrow, lowbrow over here. So Who Weekly is, like you said, a celebrity podcast, but hosted by two extremely smart folks, Bobby Finger and Lindsay. It's hosted by two amazing folks who are writers, Bobby and Lindsay. They love celebrity culture, and they love deconstructing celebrity culture, and they love poking fun at it. But at the end of the day, I mean, they always have sort of respect for the celebrity hustle, and it's just so clever. And the conceit is really the world of celebrity is divided into who's and them's, and the who is like who is that person again? And the them is, you know, like a Tom Cruise, somebody that everybody knows. And they're so clever and thoughtful and whip smart. I mean, they're so quick. And it's breezy. That is the thing that I listen to when I'm going, when I'm driving in the car somewhere and I have an hour or two and I just download a bunch of their episodes and sort of mainline them.
Okay. And so it's Bobby Finger. Is it Lindsay Weber? Is she?
Yeah. Who Weekly is hosted by Lindsay Weber and Bobby Finger, who are two amazing writers.
Nick, one of your other recommendations was Bodega Boys. Can you tell us about that?
I'm also giving this recommendation because I'm curious whether you guys have actually shouted them out in public radio. This is an extremely profane and raunchy sort of pop culture show.
Yeah, I follow them on Twitter, so I've like at least I feel like they're like my social media people. These guys, so
I love them so much. It's hosted by two comedians, two sort of like personalities, two men of color from the Bronx, Desus and Kid Mero, and the Bodega Boys. It's this sort of really chaotic, raucous conversation in which these two comedians sort of like catch up with stuff that's happened on the week. Usually political and pop culture, sometimes personal, but it's, you know, I listen to it largely as just a meditation space. I like putting it on the back.
Right next to Krista Tippett?
Right next to Krista. It's like a little strange because they are so joyous and like happy to be alive, and this was celebratory in a very defined way. And I feel like I'm generally a very sort of paranoid, scared person when I walk out on the street in general, anywhere, wherever I am. And so I listen to Bodega Boys in the background just to sort of like give me that sort of vibe. Like I treat it almost as music. It's just sort of this feeling that it gets me into. Like a fun fact is that I'm really afraid of flying, and I often listen to Bodega Boys on loop in plane flights because it just kind of amps me up and gets me through that experience.
As opposed to an actual meditation app. That's hilarious. That's great.
Right. That's
so I would be remiss in saying, of course, we're almost out of time, but the other broadcast radio show that you should listen to is Lauren's. It's called The Big Listen. It's a production of WAMU and NPR in Washington, D.C. You can catch that in podcast format. I also want to thank Nick Kwa. He writes a newsletter about podcasts called Hot Pod. You can subscribe to that. He also contributes to podcast reviews for Vulture. Lauren, Nick, thanks for being with me.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On this Good Friday, we revisit our conversation with Ignatian spiritual leader Becky Eldridge. I spoke to her at the beginning of Lent, and as we reach the end of the Christian Lenten season, we thought it would be appropriate to revisit that interview. Ignatius of Loyola founded the Jesuit order in the 16th century. 500 years later, as a teenager in Baton Rouge, Becky Eldridge found herself having a spiritual awakening. Decades later for her, as a working professional and busy mom, she still finds herself incorporating that meditative practice Ignatius created as a daily spiritual exercise. How others can also do that is outlined in a new book she wrote called Busy Lives, Restless Souls. It was published earlier this year on Ash Wednesday. Becky, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks so much for having me.
So you write in your book that Ignatius had the foresight to know that the interior life has to be adapted to fit the circumstances of our exterior lives. And I was wondering, what is it about a spiritual discipline that was created 500 years ago that still has resonance today?
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about it, was that it was created 500 years ago, and there's this legacy to it. And I think the big thing for me that I find personally that it still resonates. And then when I watch, you know, just in my ministry work with other people, as I teach them about Ignatian spirituality, is just that idea of being a contemplative in action, and meaning that we can go about and live our lives in the world and have the many various hats that we wear and the many responsibilities we have, but we can still pause and make time for daily prayer, and how that prayer time with God impacts the rest of everything. And I think Ignatius figured out, you know, he was such a saint, you know, and a man at the time. He wasn't a saint at the time, but he was living just out in the world, and he wasn't cloistered in a monastery or tucked away as a hermit. He was living and preaching and everything out in the world, and that's still what we're doing today. And his wisdom can still be applied and speak to us in 2017.
And I guess my first question to you about that is, why do you think it's so hard for people to take time out of their day to stop and make time for prayer or meditation or to think about things? Do you think it's just not something we think about on a daily basis?
I think we're hungry for it, right? I think we all want to be able to do it. And right now our lives, I think, are just so full and they're so busy. And there's so many gifts of technology and the connectedness that we have online, and, you know, it really can connect us in a more global sense and stuff. But I find the kind of other side of that is it's really hard to disconnect, and it's hard to put work down sometimes, you know, or it's hard. I'm a mom of three kids, and, you know, the teachers might be emailing us, you know, and at 9 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, and you'll get something, a reminder about a project or, you know, a crazy day at school that's coming up and they need such and such socks or whatever. So I think the thing is there's always this information that's coming to us, and it makes it challenging to give yourself permission to pause. I think that's one thing. And I think the other thing is, I think because our lives are so busy and they're so full and we have so much going on, that when we do stop, sometimes we can be afraid of what we're going to find when we sit in the silence, you know, and kind of confront and face things that the busyness and the over-connectedness and the overfull calendars can sometimes, you know, buffer us from thinking about.
I wonder what you say to people who say that they're failed meditators, who kind of freak out at the notion of spending time in silence. Is that what this is about?
Well, I always lean on the wisdom of a priest friend of ours that's down here in Baton Rouge, and he was the pastor of a parish that my husband and I were when we were newlyweds, and he always shared with us, because I can remember telling him one time, you know, how do I pray? Like, I have a newborn now, and I'm working, and at the time I was getting my graduate degree, and he always said, pray as you can, not as you can't. And that, to me, I think we can sometimes beat ourselves up and that we're not doing it right. You know, we don't know how to pray, or we feel like we're not still enough or silent enough, or maybe we feel like we don't know how to do it. But the reality is God meets us as we are, you know? And so, yeah, there's going to be days that we can pray and have lengthy times of silence and solitude. But then some days and some seasons of life, what we may get is just moments of pause, turning our heart and mind to God throughout the day. And I think what Ignatius, his gift is he arms us. There's so much wisdom in Ignatian spirituality that helps us pray our lives. You know, and I think that's when his like prayer of the examine, you know, that's so often credited to St. Ignatius founding. And I know that there's some talk of people before him using it, but that prayer of the examine and, you know, taking the last 24 hours of your life and praying it and bringing it before God is just as beautiful and profound of a prayer as sitting for an hour in silence, you know. And sometimes our life allows for one, and sometimes our life, you know, allows for the other.
And so when we think about that, the notion of prayer and the daily examine, I want to get into what the daily examine is. But because you mentioned that, I wanted to ask you, because so much of Ignatian spirituality centers around prayer, what does prayer mean to you? How do you define what prayer is?
Oh, that's such a good question. What is prayer? I mean, I think my first definition, if I was going to grab, would be that simple act of pausing and turning your mind and heart to God, you know. And so that type of prayer can happen throughout our entire day, you know. I mean, many, many different times we can stop and notice what's before us, you know, kind of how Jesus in, I think it's Matthew, says, you know, consider the sparrows, you know, and what is it that the sparrows have to teach us is his sermon he's talking about. But what is before us, and what is God saying to us in that moment? You know, is there something God might be offering to us? But then we can also take that same notion of turning our mind and heart to God if we're sitting with Scripture, you know, or maybe we're just sitting in silence and it's just a word we're holding. But I think prayer is just that way of us communicating with God, and God communicating also with us.
And that kind of leads me to the Daily Examine, which is something that is a really important part of Ignatian spiritual practice. And you talk about it in the book as a way to sort of go back through your day. What's the point of that?
Gosh, the Examine is one of my favorite prayer tools. Can I just say that?
Sure.
I learned the Examine, like you mentioned, that I'm from Baton Rouge, and I learned the Examine at a time of my life when it was right after Hurricane Katrina, and I'm sure many people remember, what that just experience was like, but living it down here, and I was in Baton Rouge, and I had several family members in New Orleans, and I was working at the Diocese of Baton Rouge at the time, and it was a very just overwhelming time of seeing people's suffering, and really a moment where I was questioning, where is God in all of this? How could God let this happen? And a priest, Father Matt Lynn, a Jesuit, taught all of us. There was a group of women, about 50 of us, taught us this prayer. And what was so profound for me about the Examine back then, and it still is now, is how it really helps you see God in all things, which can be such this cliche statement that gets attached with Ignatian spirituality. Somebody's like, well, what? Tell me about Ignatian spirituality. Somebody's probably going to say, oh, it's about finding God in all things. And the idea of the Examine is just to pause and review, bring your last 24 hours before God and ask God to help you see where God has been present, maybe where we've struggled to name God's presence, and what is that about? Does it have something to do with my choices, my actions, my inactions, or maybe an opportunity I could have said something and I didn't? But the Examine just remains for me personally, and I've loved teaching this prayer to so many people because it's a prayer that we can do at any time. We can be sitting in our car and we can take a few minutes and bring the last 24 hours before God and ask for God's guidance and help.
I'm speaking with Becky Eldridge. She's the author of a book called Busy Lives, Restless Soul. And we're talking about her book, which is about Ignatian spirituality. And, Becky, when you say that the idea of seeing God in all things, I'm thinking about, you write about this in the book, being in Baton Rouge. And I wonder if you can sort of share your experience of how you were able to, you talk about how difficult it was to go through Katrina, how your family members were directly impacted,
yes.
Your sister-in-law who was working in a hospital in New Orleans. How did you see God in something like Katrina?
Oh, I mean, it gives me goosebumps even thinking about it. But at the time, like when it was happening, it was just overwhelming to see the suffering. And I was working at the Diocese of Baton Rouge at the time, and Catholic Charities was right across the parking lot. And so, the impact of Katrina was way beyond just the day that it happened in August, and for 18 months, I watched people line up outside of our doors, waiting for help. And Baton Rouge's population doubled. We were just inundated with people and resources. And so it took me a really long time. I would say at first, I don't know if I could say I felt like I was seeing God in all things and seeing God in that. But then when I prayed the Examine, and when Father Matt invited us, and I think he sensed that we as the women in that retreat house needed something to help process what we had all gone through.
Which wasn't silence,
and
I guess, at that point.
Which,
right?
We were in the silence. We were all supposed to be quiet, but everybody was talking because I think it was just that's what we needed, is to share some of our stories and then also have the opportunity to say, hey, here's where we're struggling and here's where we're not. And when he taught that prayer, it was the first time I was able to kind of really say, oh my goodness, like God was profoundly present in the people who were doing the work, who were getting on the boats and getting people out, you know, who were getting on people's roofs and pulling people off, you know, and the people that were opening up their homes and to strangers. I mean, just rank strangers they didn't know, and they would open up their house and they'd have them stay with them. And so it was this reminder that all these prayers, I think, that were being offered, you know, and cried out, and all the suffering that was being seen, that God was responding to those prayers through empowering and calling people to serve and to act. And when I finally got that, I mean, it was just the most freeing moment, and just, like I felt like I could breathe and think, okay, well, we weren't abandoned, you know, at that time.
You know, and when you think about that, you think about, you were saying you were with all of these women. You write about this in the book, and I wanted to ask you, women, you say women ask you this all the time. How do you find the time to pray or to do all of this when you're a mom?
Yeah, it's a hard question, you know? and it's one I've lived and continue to live and learn into, because seasons of motherhood change, you know? And so right now, you know, I think women have this great gift, though, of being intentional about what matters. And I think that when I look at the beautiful women in my life, you know, friends, family, colleagues, you can give a woman a task that matters and they're going to get it done. And I think that it's that same intentionality that we can apply to our prayer lives, even as a mom, you know, even when we've got all these people that might need our attention and our care. And, you know, right now, like for me, my prayer time is I get up before my kids do, you know, and sometimes it's hard. And if my 10-year-old was on the phone, he'd tell you I hit snooze sometimes. But, you know, I think we can make time for prayer because it's making time for the relationship that matters the most in our life. And we can do that by honoring it on our calendar the way we would any appointment. So maybe that means we're getting up early, or maybe that means we're carving out a little time in the evening or in our day. And the other thing I tell moms all the time is to be kind of courageous in asking for the time from the rest of the family, you know, and saying, this is going to be my prayer time. And can you, you know, mom's going to go in here and please don't disturb me for a few minutes. Or, it really took some time for me to have the courage to ask my family for that, both to ask my husband, Chris, and my kids to say, okay, when I'm in there, can you leave me be and let me have that time? And it really, getting that support from your family and the people or whoever's living in your home, I think is a valuable thing.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but that is a little bit of how Becky Eldridge, she's talking about the book, very aptly named Busy Lives, Restless Souls. It's out now. Thanks so much for being with us, Becky. I really appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you, Nyla. I so appreciate the invitation to be with you.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Big news in the circus world recently when Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey announced that their final performance will be next month after a 146-year run. For a company that's been around almost as long as baseball and is arguably the most iconic circus in the U.S., what does this news mean for the future of circus arts? And what does it look like to run off and join the circus today? To discuss all of this, we're joined on the line now by someone who spent her entire life in this world, including a stint with Ringling Brothers. Sylvia Hernandez de Sassi is the artistic director and co-founder of the Actors Gymnasium in Evanston. Sylvia, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I should mention, you did not run off and join the circus. You grew up in the circus. Your parents were performers. What was that like?
Well, I started performing when I was 7. My mother was given to a circus family during the war in Germany. So she started performing when she was a young girl, and then met my father and decided that that's what we should do with, you know, with our lives. And it was just my life, you know. It was, people say, was it glamorous? Was it this? Was it that? And I just like, well, at the time, it was just my life. It's all I knew. So it wasn't, you know, I didn't even think of it as something that was so unusual.
Did you move around a lot? How did that work?
Yeah, we traveled in RVs, and we had a home base in Sarasota, Florida, which is where Ringling was based. But we traveled mostly like 10 months out of the year with circuses, various circuses, while I was growing up, and a lot of very traditional tent circuses and some circuses that were in arenas. And it wasn't until later in my career that we joined Ringling Brothers.
And at what age, you said you began performing at 7. What did you do before then? Did you just kind of watch everybody else? Were you doing things on your own? What kind of performing did you do?
Well, I was an acrobat, and my brother, who was older than I was, started performing with my mother and father. And I was, you know, a little kid, and I would watch them, and I would train on the off times. To be an acrobat, to fly off the teeter board is what we did. And I did, you know, hand balancing. I did a little bit of everything. The circus was kind of my playground. So I learned to unicycle and juggle and fly on the trapeze. And that's just what you do when you're a kid in the circus, which is kind of how, you know, the idea of, you know, teaching circus to kids became a thing. It's because it's what I did for fun, because it's what was available to me, you know, because I was in the circus and here's a unicycle. So, you know, my friend rode a unicycle in her act, and then we, you know, we trained, cross-trained for everybody, you know, everybody learned everything. So that's why I don't think that was unusual to me. I think that was what every kid in the circus did. And that's why I think the involvement of circus schools came into play.
Yeah. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because I think that when children are 4 and 5 and 6, kids who are fearless are pretty fearless, right? They just think that it's super fun and they don't think about the risks involved and they're so flexible. Would you agree?
Yeah, actually that's a really good point. I noticed, and I didn't notice at the time, that I have a younger brother. And I watched him train after he was much younger than I was and I watched him train, and I watched the realization come as he got older that some of the stuff he was doing was dangerous or scary. But by that time, it's already ingrained in your body, and you don't even have to think about it. So it's an interesting thing. If you're trying something that you know is dangerous, you're going to have a harder time overcoming that hurdle than when you're trained at a young age. You learn it when you're not scared, and then it becomes second nature.
Well, it's part of your muscle memory, too, it sounds like. Interesting. And when I think about that, what the idea of the circus arts, I think, are really popular in the fitness world. Lots of people in big and small cities all across I'm thinking even just across Illinois, whether it's Chicago or Champaign or Evanston, there's studios that offer classes where anyone can take classes in trapeze or silks or hoops. Do you see that as kind of a newer phenomenon? Has that become much more popular in the past couple of years?
Yeah, most definitely. And the reason for me that I started doing a strict fitness class, because I realized how strong people are that do circus. So why not use it at the other end and try, you know, and use it as a way of getting strong, as opposed to I'm strong because I do circus. Do circus to get strong, you know, specifically for that reason. So that's great for someone who, you know, might be bored with a workout or may not be interested in performing in front of an audience, just getting stronger. It is the best full body workout, mind, body, everything workout, because there's, you know, learning to think upside down is a phrase I use a lot because I work with Northwestern students as well. And to train someone who's really smart to, you know, to think outside their comfort zone, you know, kind of opens up a new world for them. And then learning to find your body parts when you're upside down, a whole new world. So there's just so many, you know, so many avenues that it's, you know, good for and worth trying because, you know, if there's something for everyone to get out of it, no matter how old, how fit, how not fit, how, you know, performer, not performer. It's just, it's and you know, it's funny because when I grew up, it was very, you know, it was handed down generation to generation, and teaching it was kind of taboo because you didn't want to give those secrets out. And now it's a much more open to a broader audience, you know, not just to watch and see, but to participate in.
I wonder how much the culture has changed because it used to mean, you know, as you said, it was a cultural thing. It was passed down from families to families. People could spend their entire lives and their children's lives in the circus. I imagine it's not really that way anymore.
No, I mean, that's the sad thing about the Ringling, folding is it was one place where that could still happen because a family could. I didn't leave my family until I was 27. So I, you know, and it was actually unheard of for a performer to leave their family. Usually what you do is you just, you know, bring
you took over.
It
was
like
family. You took over
you
the family
really
business.
You don't leave the family. And the Ringling, because of the housing setup and being able to travel with big groups, you know, your family could stay together. And that's one reason why it's really heartbreaking for me, because that is a part of the era that not everybody knows, you know. So some people see, oh, it's just gone, and, you know, a lot of people are out of work. But that culture can't be duplicated anywhere else but on the Ringling Show. And it was expensive. It's an expensive, you know, like thing to be able to have a, because my troupe had 10 people in it when I was on Ringling. And if I were to be, you know, traveling with the circus now, I would need, you know, at least, you know, 5 RVs because it's different, you know, different parts of your family, different family members need to live in, you know, we don't all live in one group unless you're, you know, kids when you get to be adults, you know. So expanding that, you know, the traveling situation, that's why there's so few family acts now, because it's too expensive.
It's just too expensive for people to travel around. I wonder, you know, when you said it was heartbreaking for you, how else is the news of Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey closing up shop next month, how else are people in sort of the circus community and the circus world? Are they also, I imagine you've been talking to a lot of people about it. What has their reaction been?
Well, you know, again, it's more about losing a iconic organization that is part of my past. As far as working goes, like a working circus performer, Ringling is, you know, was more about bringing, you know, bringing people in from other countries, big troops that they could, you know, that in China or in Russia or, you know, in the Eastern European countries, they tend to put acts together that are not families and then send them over to Ringling Brothers that can house them on the train. We were an American pedalboard troupe, which is like a springboard where you jump on one end, and I was the flyer and I would fly off the other end.
And was this on a wire?
No, it's on the ground and it's like a teeter-totter.
Ah, okay.
And then I would fly up to 5 high or into a chair.
Oh, my gosh.
So
when you said, like, jobs being lost, are there smaller companies that are going to fill in the gap, or will people be leaving? What's the sense of what you think will happen?
Well, I think that people, you know, like I said, a lot of the acts that came in on Ringling were, you know, from Europe and China and, you know, like, not a lot of American individuals. Like, what I, you know, like, the circus schools are training individuals to go out and perform circus. So the effect on that, like, the, you know, my students graduating and performing in circus is not huge, because that's not how Ringling hired performers. They usually came in families, or they came in troops from, you know, across the country. I mean, across the world.
I think it also is such a, you said it was iconic for you in history, but I also think it's an iconic for American history. And I wonder if you can kind of help us give a sense of what you think the role is in sort of a broader American cultural history, the circus of the past 150 years almost.
American audiences have changed quite a bit. You know, they're not as interested in sitting really far away and watching little tiny people perform. They want to be up close and personal. They want to see.
Or do it themselves, right?
They want to see human, human reactions. So with Ringling Brothers being in a huge, Allstate Arena type thing, or, it's hard to connect with a performer, which is why so many smaller companies are doing so much better, because the audience is closer and the audience, can get, see the performer's efforts that they're putting in. They can see their sweat and they can see their focus. And I think that is something that human connection is something that people want, even if they don't know it yet. But I think that's why smaller circuses are, going to thrive for years to come, because they are offering that human connection where you can go in. It's like seeing theater. You're sitting that close to a performer and you're seeing you're feeling their pain, sort of. You're having a visceral reaction to what they're doing, as opposed to sitting, in the nosebleed section and, watching people do amazing feats of danger
but
you're not really feeling it. You're just seeing it, and people can see that on TV or they can see it on their phones, but actually feeling connected and seeing human to human interactions, I think, is what's key for the future.
And as you think about that, you're now the artistic director and you're co-founder of the Actors Gymnasium in Evanston, which offers circus arts classes as well as contortion and clowning and gymnastics. I know you have theater students that come to your circus arts classes. What advice do you give to your students who maybe want to pursue a career in the circus?
I think being a diverse performer is the key, which is why I really try to inspire my students to be versatile. Like, don't just perform on the silks, also be able to juggle and also be able to tumble and also be able to, be a performer that, another performer can rely on, be someone who's in a process where you're supporting your company members, not just physically, but emotionally, and being willing to take chances and, just let other people take physical risks in front of you, emotional risks in front of you. It just builds a community that can produce beautiful art. You can't just be a phenomenal aerialist anymore. You have to be able to offer whatever is asked of you.
Sylvia Hernandez de Stasi is the artistic director and co-founder of the Actors Gymnasium in Evanston. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I love your show.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have the NPR One app for Alexa, we're pretty easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us, whether you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman and Alan Montesilio. Abrar Alhiti is our intern. Engineering help comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.